Hey, Dune Met fans, welcome to another episode of the Terry Collins Show, presented by Tunnel to Towers, supporting America's greatest heroes. Donate just $11 per month by going to t2t.org. That's T, the number 2T.org. I'm John Arezzi, and joining me direct from Mets Fantasy Camp down at Port St. Lucie is the former skipper of the Mets, the man who's back in the dugout for at least this week with the Fantasy Camp attendees, Mr. Terry Collins. Terry, how's it going down there?
It's going great, John. We hope the weather holds out for us. It looks like we're going to get a little wet down here a little bit, but it's great to be with these campers, huge Mets fans. Love talking the game, love playing the game, and you know, you tip your hat to them. A lot of these guys, I mean, they're out here and they're banged up, pulled muscles, and they don't miss it. They don't miss a trick. Boy, they love every second of it. So it's very, very entertaining. And you know, and as I talk to them every day, I said, you know, it's our way as former Mets to say thank you to these guys. I mean, they love and support the Mets, and so to be here, be a part of them, give them some fun, it's worth every second.
It is a fantasy for a lot of these guys, and a lot of these guys return and come back year after year for this experience. So I know that you know, a few of the people that we've heard from were so excited that you're in the dugout. And there was a guy, actually a pitcher who pitched a game yesterday, and we got a couple of pictures, which we'll put up of this gentleman, and his name is Jim Ford. And so tell us about him. He looks like an older gentleman, but he was out there pitching and he had a good game. I guess you guys won 8-3.
Yep. And you know, Jimmy's been, I don't know how many camps this has been, maybe 20. He pitches every year, 60 some years old, you know, throws it over. That's the best part. And loves it, loves every second of being out here. And again, just, you know, this is what the camp is all about. It doesn't matter how old you are. You know, they're playing, and this guy, they play, you know, I didn't realize this, but they actually have leagues for these guys around the country. You know, 55 and over, and they play a lot of baseball. They love the game. And that's what's fun about being here. And, you know, I talked to him on the bench. I said, you know, the fact that you guys are playing this game, and no matter how old you are, you realize how hard the game is still right now. I said, can you imagine how hard it is for the guys who really know how to play this game? I mean, the guys making a lot of money, it's hard for them too. So it gives them a great perspective of what, you know, what baseball, professional baseball is all about.
Yeah. Jim also mentioned that he was, you know, just thrilled to death to have you, you know, in the dugout there. But he also mentioned Josh Tolley, who I guess is working with you.
Yeah, I've got Josh Tolley's my coach. And, you know, there's some guys, I mean, we just played the team. Mackie Sasser is the manager, and he's got Mookie Wilson and Rafael Santana as his coaches. Great guys down there. And I'm going to tell you something about these coaches. They love this. They love these guys. And a lot of them have been here year after year after year. It's something they do. I mean, they actually have a Hall of Fame, a Mets Fantasy Camp Hall of Fame, and some of the coaches are in it. They get rings, they get awards, and these coaches love these guys. And they become friends. They see each other during the seasons, you know, when the baseball season's going on, and they know that every year they're coming back and they're seeing those same faces. And it truly is amazing. And it's just an honor to be a part of this and to watch these, you know, some of the greatest play. Doc's here, Doc Gooden's here. And, you know, of course, John, you know, Doc, here's one of the mega stars who ever played this game. And he is involved with these guys, talking to them, helping them out. It's really fun to see.
I think Swoboda is there too, from the 69 Mets, right?
Here. Ron Swoboda's here. You know, Doug Flynn, Bobby Wine is here. Bobby Wine, he's basically one of the commissioners, and he's the judge when they do the kangaroo court. And, you know, there's no funnier guy on the face of the earth than Bobby Wine. So, and he's beloved by these campers.
Yeah, there's a great experience for everybody, but there was a surprise guest that showed up yesterday, and it was the owner of the New York Mets. He showed up at fantasy camp. Tell us about that.
I thought it, to be honest, John, I got to tell you, I thought it was one of the coolest things I have ever seen. Yeah. Here's a man, obviously, who is unbelievably busy, not just with the ownership of the Mets, but his own business himself. Take time to come down here and have his picture and hang out with these guys at lunch, during lunch hour like yesterday, talking to him, getting his picture taken with him, coming out and watching some of the game in the afternoon. I thought it was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. It's just Steve Cohen, again, respecting the fan and what it means. And, you know, and Steve's a Mets fan himself, but just to, as a thank you and just to say, hey, look, I just really appreciate it, what all you guys do. I thought it was one of the great things I've ever seen.
That's awesome, Terry. I mean, that was such a surprise for a lot of the campers that went there, and I'm sure even for yourself. So that was a wonderful gesture by Cohen, for sure. The Mets are making some news down in the general manager's meetings that are taking place in Gibby's hometown there in San Antonio. John Gibbons, there was an announcement made yesterday by David Stearns that the entire coaching staff is being brought back for 2025. Wanted to get your opinion on that.
Well, they all deserve to come back. I mean, the job they did to, you know, get that team through with a rough start and to keep their heads up and to keep them plugging along. And I think they all deserve to come back. And I'm real proud of the fact that they are coming back. I think it's great. You know, there's something in the game about that continuity helps, where guys are comfortable. You know, it's really one thing to have, you know, coaching changes all the time, because now you got a player who maybe really likes what, you know, Jeremy Hefner has to say. And if you keep flipping out pitching coaches, man, it gets confusing to a pitcher, or the same as on the hitting side. And so I think it's great that the coaching staff's coming back, and they certainly all deserve to come back.
Yeah, it was a very quick decision, and David Stearns had a press conference yesterday, and he, you know, when he was asked, you know, what's going on with the coaching staff, and he immediately said they're all coming back, and that's pretty cool to see. Yeah, that it's such a very early part of the postseason to do that, but Stearns is busy right now. All the free agents have been filing, and qualifying offers have been made. So it's going to be very interesting postseason this year that we'll watch pretty closely. But I wanted to get and go back to the World Series, Terry. I mean, the series is now over. The Dodgers have won. They beat the Yankees in 5 games. So it was a very exciting series. I had a couple of questions to ask you about that. But the first thing I want to bring up is on March 26th, SNY analysts made their picks on who would win the 2024 Fall Classic. It was you along with Andy Martino, Todd Zeal, Jim Duquette, Jerry Blevin, Sal Licata, John Harper, and 7 other SNY affiliates made their selections. And just a few of them got it right. Yourself, Jim Duquette, and that was pretty cool. So you knew right away, and you picked the Dodgers, and here they are, World Series champions.
Well, you know, one of the reasons I picked the Dodgers is because I did not expect them to have 7 of their – some of the best starting pitchings on disabled list all summer long. But, you know, again, it's a tribute to their organization and what they've done over there. They have – you know, they've got – they stocked themselves with – talented guys. They signed the right free agents. They've got some good young pitching talent. They really, really bolstered their bullpen, which is what the game is about today. And you just knew. I mean, when it came postseason, you know, you got a $300 million payroll and you don't have 4 starting pitchers that you can run out there. You've got to run a bullpen, 2 bullpen games in the playoffs. I mean, it just tells you how good their lineup really and truly was to get through that lineup. And, you know, and that's where they won. They won because they could score.
They're an amazing team this year. I mean, of course, they beat the Mets, but beating the Yankees in a way, they were just a powerhouse. But there's one thing I want to bring up. Game 5, 5th inning. In a game led by the Yankees at that point, 5-0, saw the meltdown of the Yankees. It's kind of epic proportions in a lot of ways. Aaron Judge drops an easy fly ball, which he normally catches 999 of 1,000 times. Anthony Volpe's bounce throw to third, which Jazz Chisholm could not handle. Then Mookie Betts grounds to first to Anthony Rizzo. Pitcher Garrett Cole didn't cover first base. A play would have ended that inning If he would have stepped on the bag, it would have ended the inning. No run scored. The floodgates opened. The Dodgers scored 5 runs with 2 outs, tied the game. And then that one inning cost the Yankees that game and a trip back to L.A. for game 6. Terry, what's your thoughts? As you're in the dugout. You're the manager. You're in the dugout, and you're seeing this unfold. What's your thoughts on this inning? And in your mind as a manager, were these miscues inexcusable?
Well, first of all, I'm sure Aaron Boone's watching this saying, I can't believe what I'm watching. I can't believe what I'm seeing. I mean, these are certainly some of the, most talented baseball players in the world making some of the most basic mistakes. Aaron Judge, took his eye off the ball just before it hit his glove. And you've got Volpe who, that ground ball play in the hole is an easy play. He got a nice easy throw and he makes a bad throw. And then the most basic play in baseball, covering first base by the pitcher, to have one of the greatest pitchers in the game not cover first base, which he's done 500,000 times in his career, was shocking to me. Yeah. And John, and that's how you lose games. I'm a true believer in playing the game correctly. Fundamentally sound baseball, hitting cutoff men, throwing to the right base, throwing strikes, making the plays that you're supposed to make. We understand errors are going to be made and there's going to be great plays, but you know what? You make the routine plays, your chances of winning increase. And what happened in that inning, I'm telling you, I have never seen anything like, especially a team that's in the World Series that is as good as the New York Yankees. And I'm going to tell you, it's got to be pretty tough winter sitting around with those guys thinking, what the heck happened here? Because certainly I said the same thing. It's 5-0. I'm getting ready to go to bed because I figure this game's over. They get in that Yankee bullpen. They're going to shut this down. And within 5 minutes, I went, I've never seen anything like this before.
It was crazy to watch. It really was. It was like, I can't believe this has happened. Finally, on the World Series, Terry, the MVP, Freddie Freeman, had a World Series for the ages, really, from that walk-off grand slam in Game 1, hitting home runs in Games 2, 3, and 4. Talk to us about the World Series Freeman had, especially with the challenges he faced in 2024. Not only broken hand earlier in the season, ankle injury he was dealing with in the postseason, and the personal issues he faced with his young son's health during the year. How special was it to witness this performance in this World Series by Freddie Freeman, eventually getting the MVP?
Well, I will tell you, I'm a big Freddie Freeman fan. When he first burst on the scene in Atlanta, you saw a special talent. And I got to like Freddie. He loves to play. He loves to be on the field. He's one of the friendliest guys. Matter of fact, he kind of ticks off his own teammates once in a while because he's always patting the other team on the back and talking to them. And, that's Freddie. He just loves to be out there. So to have what he went through this year, not only physically but mentally with what happened with his son, I mean, he talked about he was ready to walk away. He was ready to walk away from the game, and to have him be the guy that rose to the occasion is a great, great story because he is such a good person. And I'm going to tell you, obviously, my time facing Freddie Freeman, he killed us. He killed the Mets my times there. So I wasn't surprised at all with what he did.
Yeah, it was an amazing performance, and you have to feel good for him, and especially everything he went through. What a gamer. What an old school guy. So congratulations to the Los Angeles Dodgers and to Freddie Freeman, the entire team. What a magical season it was for them. Terry, Tunnel to Towers will be breaking ground this week for a Veterans Village in Denver. They'll provide permanent housing for homeless vets. Facility also will have a full slate of services for those who need them, including job training, benefits assistance, mental health support. It's the third groundbreaking in the past 3 weeks for the foundation's homeless veteran program. The other villages are in Detroit and Charleston, South Carolina. And this week, Tunnel to Towers will announce its Veterans Day mortgage payoffs. The foundation removes the financial burden for Gold Star and falling first responder families with young children. And TC, finally, later in the show, in our amazing Hero of the Week segment, we're going to debut the Tunnel to Towers story we shot at Citi Field earlier this year with Mets legend and Hall of Famer Mike Piazza. So keep tuned for that, everybody watching. But Terry, this guy has helped us so much, not only with the show this year, but with Tunnel to Towers. I want to give a very special shout out, not only to Mike Piazza for participating, but especially the Jay Horowitz for helping putting it all together. This is the type of guy Jay is.
Oh yeah, he's the best. He's the best. And you know what? His what he's done for the New York Mets, and you know, and all the former players. He heads up the alumni now. He's a special person. And when the time comes that Jay said, "Hey, look, it's time for me to retire," there better be something special prepared for his retirement.
Nobody like him, I'll tell you. What a great guy. We'll be back with This Week in Mets History right after this from Tunnel of Towers. And former New York Met, the man who hit that Grand Slam single back in 1999, Robin Ventura.
Hi, I'm former Major League Baseball player Robin Ventura, asking you to help Tunnel to Towers. I have a lot of admiration and love for what first responders do. You can't thank them enough, but you can support them, giving back to people that basically risk their lives for us every day. A donation of just $11 a month will go a long way. Go to t2t.org for more information on how you can help.
Now it's time for This Week in Mets History. On November the 3rd, 1986, Mets third baseman Ray Knight is featured on the cover of Sports Illustrated after being named the World Series MVP, hitting .391 with the go-ahead home run in Game 7, leading the Mets to their last World Series title. On November the 2nd, 2015, Daniel Murphy also appears on a Sports Illustrated cover when he had his incredible postseason, setting an MLB record by hitting home runs in 6 consecutive postseason games. He was the NLCS MVP after hitting .529 in that series against the Cubs. You can follow NYM History on Instagram to learn more about the history of the New York Mets. And now it's time for Talking with TC. Today on Talking with TC, we welcome one of the members of the SNY Mets broadcast team. He's been with SNY since 2013. His first assignment was covering a Brooklyn Cyclones game, and that was just the beginning. In 2014, he filled in for Kevin Burkhardt for 50 games that season and replaced Kevin in 2015 when Burkhardt left for Fox Sports. He's been the on-field reporter since then. He also covers the New York Jets for SNY. He's been nominated 4 times for the New York Emmy Awards, and along with Keith Hernandez, Gary Cohen, and Ron Darling, won the 2019 Sterling Award for the best MLB broadcasting team. It's a pleasure to welcome, for the first time on Talking with TC, Steve Gelbs. Steve, how you doing?
I'm great. When you asked if I could do this, I thought I owed about 1,000 of these to Terry, because I can't even begin to calculate how many times I, as the host, asked to interview him. So more than happy to do this. Excited to be on, guys.
Well, we're really glad to have you on, Steve. You know, you and I spent a lot of time together, man. Throughout the years, and of course, I still watch it, and it still entertains me like crazy to see what antics you're doing to entertain the fans for the broadcast. And you know, you bring so much to the broadcast because it's a whole different perspective that the fans don't see that you bring to them. And I just think it's wonderful to have you on, and we're gonna talk about some of those things.
Great. Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to it, man. Shoot, whatever you want.
You know, Steve, you were there in 2015. You were there, you know, during the Buck era when they, you know, got in the playoffs. And then this year, can you compare any of them to what you saw this summer?
No, I really can't. And I'll be honest with you, Terry. I mean, you know, that 2015 season was about as special as it gets. And I really did not think that I would ever cover anything close to it. And if possible, I know that the team didn't make it to the World Series this year, but this may have surpassed it. I mean, you look at those two seasons, and they're definitely at the top of my list. But in 2015, there were signs. And I remember talking to you going into that season quite a bit in spring training. You saw the pitching coming, right? You get Matt Harvey coming back. There were reasons to believe that this would be the year that you guys could get over that hump, make the playoffs. And then certainly, you know, the type of run and the magic that was there, and the Wilmer Flores moment and the Cespedes, just, you know, otherworldly performance. It took it to a whole new level, and Murphy in the playoffs. But this season, and you know, in 2015 too, like that team, you guys started off really well also.
Right, yeah.
This season, came out of nowhere and started off as poorly as could be. And, you know, in late May, it was looking like it was going to be a disaster of a season. And to have it turn on a dime the way that it did, and to have so many things happen that just, you know, it's hard to even explain. Like, it's hard to explain a guy like Jose Iglesias, who was out of baseball a year ago, come up, hit 337, release a number one hit that sparks the entire team. Like, that never happens. Never. How could you ever expect something like that to happen? And so there were so many things and so many moments. And then certainly the way they got into the playoffs, the way they won the first round of the playoffs, the way they beat the Phillies, it was about as special as it gets. Because I think, and I said this to somebody as the run was going on, the best seasons in sports are the ones where the expectations are non-existent and you far exceed them. The worst seasons are the 2023s when the expectations are sky high and they don't come close. So 2015 was amazing, but 2024, I would have to say, is as good as it's ever been for me covering a team.
That, you know, that I got to tell you, I felt the same way. I mean, I lived 2015 and how special it was, but to watch what happened this year. And, you know, I talked to Carlos two or three times during the summer, and, you know, especially in May, I called him in May and said, "Hey man, just hang in there. You know, it can't get worse. It's got to get better." And sure enough, he turned it around. I thought he did an absolutely exceptional job.
Yeah. So, you know, for me, that is probably the number one takeaway from this season, is that after years and years of turnover, Mets have not had stability since you in that role. There's been so much turnover, and, you know, you want to have the right person in place, but you also need some time to build a program out and bring some stability. And I think when you look at where the Mets are as an organization right now, you never know exactly what's going to happen, but I think they've got stability now in the manager's role. I think they've got stability now with David Stearns, and you know that Steve and Alex at the top are going to give them as much resources as they need. And so, you know, for me, with Carlos Mendoza, he was a revelation. I did not know much about him. As soon as they made the hire, I heard only good things. But you really never know how somebody is going to handle the downtimes. And we saw very early on how Mendoza handled the valleys. And that, to me, was the most impressive thing to happen, is he was the exact same guy the day he got the job, day one of spring training, the 0-5 start, the 11 games under, as he was when things were getting really good and they clinch and they win. He was as steady as it comes, which for a first-year manager in New York City, almost unheard of. So, right. You know, if you're a Mets fan, you got to be really excited about the guy you've got leading the charge now.
Right. So, Steve, your broadcast team, I mean, how much fun is it to work with those guys?
It doesn't feel like work. Let's put it that way. And, you know, I say this a lot of times, that beyond just the enjoyment that I get from working with them, they have pushed me to a point of growth in my career that just, you know, it's hard to fully quantify. Like, when I started, you know, Terry, I mean, you were great. You were great with me, and I will never be able to repay you for how patient you were. But when I started, I didn't know what I was doing. I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. And I was taken over for truly the greatest to ever do this job in Kevin Burkhardt. And I think his career has gone pretty well since he left this role as well. So, you know, it took some time for me to grow into the role. And the one thing that I realized pretty early on is this was not going to be the type of broadcast team that's going to coddle me. Like, they'll give me advice and they'll give me help, but I need to figure out how to contribute in a meaningful way. And if I didn't, if I said something that wasn't correct or wasn't interesting, they would either ignore it or they would refute it on the air. And, you know, and honestly, it didn't feel great at the time, but it was what I needed, because it really pushed me to say, okay, what do I have to do to get better? What do I have to do to find things that interest these guys? How do I have to kind of carve out my own role on this broadcast that brings what I'm good at to the table? And so it took some time, but once I got there and once I understood what our broadcast is all about, then it just became as fun as can be. And I think, you know, for me, the most fun aspect of it is the freedom that comes with it. There are a lot of broadcasts, and this is no knock on any others, but it's kind of structured. This is what we're going to do tonight, and this is when the sideline reporter is going to come on, and he's going to do an injury report. She's going to do an injury report, or you know, recap something the manager said in the pregame press conference. We go into every day, we have a loose idea, but we just let the night take us where it's going to take us. And sometimes that is going to be just a phenomenal game on the field, and I've got to be locked into my, you know, P's and Q's with the baseball stuff. Sometimes it's going to be a blowout at Wrigley Field, and Ron Darling's like, hey, Steve, why don't you go out there and see what's going on with the cup snake in the bleachers? And then I'm going to go out there and I'm going to, you know, interview a guy that probably had too many to be on TV and it just barely worked out for us. But that's the, it's a freedom that doesn't exist in a lot of places. And I think it comes from trust and us having done this for so many years together and this mutual understanding that it's all about the show and it's all about the entertainment of the fan, and whatever that may be on any given night, that's what it's going to be. And we're going to let it take us where it takes us.
Well, it has really been entertaining. So this summer, Steve, you do so many interviews with guys. Who was the one guy this summer you interviewed that was exciting for you?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think I really enjoyed talking to Jose Iglesias because I enjoyed seeing a guy who had been so successful in the game, who still was willing to do whatever it took to hang on to the game because he felt like he had more to give. And he was very honest about how close he came to walking away and how angry he was at the league for not valuing what he brought to the table. You know, you look at the guy's 2022, he hit, I think it was 282 playing shortstop almost every day and didn't even get a job a year later because the analytics said, well, he chases too much and he's not a good defender. Not a good defender. I mean, Terry, you know, I remember a great conversation that we had with you. There were a couple of us. I don't remember what you were back for. Maybe it was Jay Horowitz, his press conference, but it was right after the Mets had brought up Jeff McNeil. And one of the reporters said something to you. We were just talking off the record. One of the reporters said to you, yeah, but, you know, his walk rate, he doesn't get on base with the walk that often. And you just looked at him and said, yeah, but does he get on base? Like, why does it matter that his walk rate isn't great? He's hitting 340. Like, he gets on base. Nice. And I think that, you know, Iglesias, you watch him play, he's one of the best. He's got one of the best gloves I've ever seen. But he didn't have great first step quickness, so he got dinged. His chase rate was bad. But you know what, Terry? He said this to me that, you know, he limited his chase to get back to the big leagues, but he was telling players when he's in the big leagues, he wants his chase rate to go up when there's two strikes. And I said, well, why would you want your chase rate to go up? He said, because you're not going to strike me out looking. And so there are all these nuances that get lost in the game today that he was really trying to reinforce and bring back. And I think seeing how committed he was to getting here again, how much he appreciated being here again, and how much some of the old school thoughts that he had contributed to the team success when he was able to talk through it with some guys, I just thought that was a really cool story. So I love talking to Iglesias. And then the other thing, and this kind of falls under the radar, but I wanted to bring it up specifically because you can really back me up on this. I was fascinated by JD Martinez and what he brought to the team behind the scenes. And I know that he didn't have the type of year production-wise on the field that everybody anticipated, and there were some that were very disappointed with his production down the stretch. But to me, he was almost an exact replica of Michael Kadire in 2015. And wow. I say to people all the time that I don't think you guys would have gotten to where you got if Kadire wasn't on that team. I thought he meant that much to the room, especially when David was out. I thought he was gracious in how he helped a guy like Conforto when he came up. And you saw the same things with JD Martinez. He helped so many guys from, you know, a hitting perspective. He was almost like another hitting coach for them. And certainly when a young kid like Mark Vientos came up, I mean, he just took him under his wing. And so those are the types of things that people don't see. but I loved watching what he brought to that team. And I think that a guy like him, a guy like Kadire at the end of their careers, probably don't get enough credit for the roles they played on both of these teams.
Well, you know, that's a tremendous compliment for JD, because you are 100% correct. When we lost David in 2015, if Michael Kadire is not in that clubhouse, and not just not taking anything away from Curtis Granderson, because he was another first class guy, but Michael Kadire led that clubhouse with David's absence, and so to have JD get that kind of a compliment because you were around both guys, that's a pretty big statement. I agree with you. I thought what he did early on with some of those meetings about, hey, look, you know, we're gonna attack here. We're not gonna sit back. We're gonna, you know, and I just thought he added a lot in that clubhouse. And again, that veteran presence. And I was around last year, Iglesias, when the Marlins brought him into spring training.
Oh,
and
that's right.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, age catches up to you, so he doesn't necessarily have the quickest. But this guy had as good a set of hands as I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once in a while, you want that shortstop. Or, you know, we saw AC Asdrubal Cabrera play on a bad knee for 2 years. And you know what? We were fine with that. Mm-hmm. Because when he got to a ball, you were out.
Yeah,
you know, he caught it and got you out, and Iglesias was pretty much the same thing. But I found him to be a very positive guy when I was around him in spring training. Very upbeat, got ready, got prepared. You know, willing to, like you said, willing to do whatever it took. So he was the one story for me this year. I was so excited about.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Terry. And I to your point about when Asdrubal got to a ball, you were out. I remember having a conversation with Mike Sarbaugh this year about Iglesias, and he said the same thing. He goes, you know, sometimes it's really nice to just have a guy that you know he is going to make the play if the ball is anywhere near him. Like sometimes guys might have better range, but they're not going to be as sure-handed. And there's a benefit to having a guy that is going to eat up everything that comes his way.
That's absolutely right. I mean, again, when you're managing a game, you got to know what your players are going to be able to do. And when you have a game, by the way, now we have all of the analysis to where to position guys. Mm-hmm. So that shouldn't help them out as much, because a lot of that time percentages are in your favor that ball is going to get hit in that general area. So
right.
If you got a guy that can catch it, it's got to make your club better. So some of the fun things you did, I mean, that you testing that food, I'm telling you, I must have laughed. I mean, I'm interested in the game, and they'd flip to you, and you wouldn't even know. I don't even know if you knew the camera was on you, and you'd be eating this sandwich, and I'm not sure if you liked it, if you're going, God, what am I going to say about this? But that cracked me up.
Well,
so how do you come up with those kind of things?
So this is what I mean about our team and our group and just the willingness to have fun. And I mean, it's a long season. We're not doing brain surgery here. And so we were all out to dinner. We had a Saturday day game in Cincinnati. We all went out to dinner. This is Gary, Keith, Ron, or whoever. I think it was Gary and Ron were on that show. So it was Gary, Ron, me, and our guys behind the scenes as well in the truck. And they start talking at dinner about how there's this vending machine, this like old vending machine that they've seen for years outside their truck. And it's got some of the most disgusting looking food. Like, who's going to get tuna fish out of a vending machine? And they said, we've never seen anybody use it. Like, who eats that stuff? And I just, because I'm a glutton for punishment and I'll do whatever it takes, I just go, I'll eat it. I'll eat it on the air tomorrow if you want. All right. So I went out. I got this burrito, this hamburger, and something else. And I said, all right, I'll eat the burrito on the air. And I went, there's a microwave in the bowels of the stadium. I heat up the burrito and I go out. And when I took the first bite that you see, I make this face because I didn't put the burrito in for long enough. So it was like, I was still taking a bite of like a cold frozen burrito. And then again, I just let it go. And we have a fun back and forth. And I'm, you know, as I'm getting into it, I'm like, you know, this actually isn't half bad, but that thing sat with me for the rest of the day. You could just feel it the entire day. And the funniest part of this whole thing, so everybody loved it. And we had such a good time. People, you know, still bring it up to me when I'm around the stadiums. But I missed the next two games because of a family commitment. And so they joked around on the broadcast that I missed it because I had food poisoning. I couldn't So we were in, I can't remember where, whatever city we went to next, but I met the team wherever they were, and I get on the bus, and David Stearns comes on the bus, and he sits in front of me, and all of a sudden he just whips his head back, and he said, "Hey, I haven't seen you since. Did you really get that sick from that burrito?" Like, I'm sorry. I'm okay. I'm fine.
So, Steve, tell me, how'd you like doing play-by-play? Because I saw the game, some of the games you did. How'd you like that?
You know, Terry, I think it's a great lesson. It was a good lesson for me. It's a great lesson for everybody. So I never in my life, not one time, had ever done any play-by-play. I had made a tape when I was like a sophomore in college trying to do a basketball game. And I was so bad and it was so hard that I was like, you know what? My brain doesn't work this way. And I kind of kept that, I guess you would call it a self-limiting belief with me throughout the entirety of my early career. And I said, I'm good at in the studio. I'm getting good at this sideline thing, but calling games I can't do. And as the years went on, Gary and Howie and some of my bosses at the network kept saying, "Hey, why don't you try it? Why don't you just try doing one game? Like you've been around so much. The fans know you now. Like just, you don't need to be Gary. Just try and, you know, have fun with it. Tell stories." And I kept saying, "No, no, 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 no." And then Wayne Randazzo left, took the Angels job 2 years ago. And there was an opening. And at that point, they kind of said, "All right, you're doing it. Like, well, you don't have a choice. You're doing it. You do one spring training game, and if you do it okay, then we'll talk about the regular season." So I did the spring training game with your former player Jerry Blevins. We had a blast, and they said, "All right, you're going to do this." And it has been so. Over the last 2 years, it has been the most challenging thing that I have ever done in this business. It is a whole new muscle. It is something that I am trying to learn on the fly when so many people do it for tens of thousands of hours in the minor leagues. But I have literally the greatest mentors you could ask for in Gary and Howie, who watch what I do and give me wonderful advice. But it has also taught me that if you stop challenging yourself and you get complacent, like you're going to kind of die on the vine a little bit. And I didn't even realize how, not complacent, but I had been doing the same thing for so many years that there were times where I could kind of go on autopilot with it. And this gave me this new, hey, you're going to get after it and you're going to fail and you got to figure out how to get back up. And there have been some moments where I was absolutely atrocious, but I feel like I'm making some good progress. And now it feels like something that excites me. Whereas it used to scare the heck out of me, now it excites me to see how much better I can get and how far I can go with it. So it's been a really, really interesting growth experience for me, and I've really enjoyed it.
Well, I think that's great. You know, I got to do a couple games with Holly, and I'm going to tell you, I was absolutely flabbergasted at how good he is and how it's natural for him. But all of the things involved to do a play-by-play game, it's not just calling out, you know, what's going on in the field. There are so many more things you got to pay attention to. Yeah. And I think you've done great. I hope you keep with it and stay with it and keep it going. I know I love your enthusiasm. I love your energy. I always did. You know, you always have a smile on your face. I've never seen you down. I've never seen you in a bad mood. So I think that's a positive thing to do. And we just want to wish you the best in all of that stuff. So I know that John's got some questions for you, so I'm going to bring him on.
All right. Thanks, Terry. Steve, you're a Queens guy, aren't you?
Born in Queens. I moved to Connecticut when I was two. But, yeah, we could say I'm a Queens guy. Rego Park. Yeah, my formative years, years one and two, I was a Queens guy.
Were you a Mets fan growing up?
No, so it's already out there. I did not. I grew up a Yankees fan. That was actually, you want a funny story. So when I got the job, when I took over for Kevin, Steve Serby did a Q&A with me in the post. And I said to our PR guy, I said, "Hey, they're going to ask me if I grew up a Yankees fan or not, a Yankees or Mets fan. Do you want me to lie?" And he was like, "No, no, no. The worst thing that could happen is you say you grew up a Mets fan, and then about 5 years down the road, there's a picture of you wearing a Yankees hat." So I said, I think it was in the post when I did it, and I think I said something along the lines of, "Yeah, But Matt Harvey grew up a Yankees fan too, you know, so it's not a big deal. But what I will say, and this is, I'm dead serious. This is not a me trying to massage it. So my dad grew up, my dad was a first generation American. His dad was from Poland. So his dad did not like baseball, was not familiar with it. And my dad just loved the game. And so he actually, his uncle was an old Brooklyn Dodgers fan and hated the Yankees. So my dad never went to a Yankee game until he was like 18, 19 years old. He would only go to Shea because his uncle was the one who would take him and wouldn't take him to any other. He hated the Yankees, wouldn't take him to a Yankee game. So when I was growing up, as much as we liked the Yankees, my dad was always, hey, we like the Mets too. And we would go to so many baseball games that we probably went to Shea and Yankee Stadium equally, because whoever was home that weekend, that's where we were going. So for me, it was never like, you know, I don't even remember until I got a little bit older, like high school age, there being this just insane vitriol from both sides. It was, I never had an issue with the Mets growing up. But now, you know, now it's, now you don't say that. Now you don't say that.
Yeah, I was, my first game was in 1966. My uncle was a diehard Yankee fan, and it was 4th of July weekend. And he said, you want to go to a ball game? I haven't been. And he took me to Shea. If he would have taken me to Yankee Stadium, I probably would have become a Yankee fan.
Well, it was all, you know, my dad, it was all Mantle, right? And that's what, same thing, like Keith.
Oh, it was Mantle. Oh,
that
yeah.
That generation,
yeah.
It was all Mantle, so.
Yeah, I got to see Mantle play at Yankee Stadium a couple times before he retired, so that was good. I go way back, but I want you to tell us your favorite Terry Collins story. I mean, you worked with him for a few years, and, you know, I always kind of ask some of the guests on, especially the announcers, what's your favorite TC story?
Putting me on the, there are so many things, seriously, that, I mean, from personal things that I mentioned this, I went over this a little bit, where I was so, I felt like I was on skates all the time my first year, and he was so gracious to me and so good to me. I remember, actually, Terry, there's no way you remember this, but I remember in 2014, you know, I was filling in for Kevin. I didn't really know the protocol. I knew we had our, pregame press conferences with Terry, but I didn't know if you were allowed to then like talk to him on the field afterwards. And I would see people, I'd see people go up and kind of chit chat with you. And so I was like building up the courage. Okay. I gotta find a way to talk to Terry at some point. And I think it was the last weekend of the season. And I went up to you on the field and I said, hi, and you could not have been nicer. And I think you told me, I don't remember if Juan Lagares had been batting second or something. You said, you know, I think I might try Lagares out at leadoff. And I said, can I say that, Terry? And you looked at me and he goes, yeah, sure. You could say that. And I thought I had the scoop of the century. I was like, I did it. I got something. I got a piece of information. So that is the first like major memory I have with Terry. But there were so many, you know, listen, I feel like I learned so much about the game just from sitting in your office and, you know, BSing. There was so many times where it was Gary, Keith, Howie, Ron, me, the radio guys, Wayne, and, you know, you'd do your, especially on the road, you'd do your press conference, and then we'd sit back, we'd ask you a few questions, and, you know, certainly you learned a lot about, or I learned a lot about the game and the mechanics of being a manager and the things that we don't know that go into a lot of decisions, but also just listening to your stories from your days with the Dodgers. And like, it was a dream come true. You know, there were so many times where I sat there and I said, I'm the guy that grew up just loving every aspect of this game. And now I'm sitting with a big league manager who's a baseball lifer, who is just throwing his wisdom out there. It was so cool for me. Wayne and I used to talk about it all the time because Wayne and I started the same year. And then the final thing was just when they clinched in 2015, and that was the first time that you had made the playoffs, and getting to interview you in the clubhouse after that game in Cincinnati. You know, you're not supposed to root, but Terry's, as I'm sure you've heard from many people, as good a guy as you're going to meet in this game. And to be able to be a small part of the experience and witness it up close and talk to him right after achieving that goal after so long, that was really, really cool.
Well, I mean, this whole season, getting a chance to do a podcast with Terry and seeing how beloved he is with everybody that we bring on and those stories that they share, it's been a very special season, as the Mets had this year. Very special season. And, of course, you remember 2015, and this this year was just incredible after the abysmal start, 0-5 to start the season, slumping in May, and then the chemistry started to change somewhat. Talk to us about the chemistry of this team this year. There were so many different dynamic and interesting personalities associated with them. I think of Jesse Winker when he came in, and what a character he has become. But talk to us about that chemistry that you noticed evolve over the course of the season and how magical the season was for Met fans.
Yeah, so, and, you know, certainly I don't need to tell Terry this because he knows, and it's one of the things that we used to talk about as analytics got so prevalent in the game. Sometimes, too often, in my opinion, the human element and what was needed to form a winning, cohesive group was lost. And that 2015 team had it. But I have not seen many teams since that I've covered have that level of buy-in from everybody and friendship in the room and kind of just everybody tugging on the same end of the rope. And I think what was really interesting to me is these last 3 years, in 2022, I remember feeling in spring training like, oh, this team's got a little something. Like you can't put your finger on it. It's hard to talk about why and what it is. But, you know, I think Scherzer coming in and everybody at that moment, it was like that room needed a leader because Lindor had a rough couple of years. And I think he needed to just kind of take a step back and not try and be everything all at once as he got acclimated to New York. And so Scherzer comes in and everybody gravitates towards him. And there was this really good feel in that clubhouse from day one. But then in 2023, and sometimes it just takes a couple of different pieces. You know, you lose a couple of guys on that pitching staff. You bring in another alpha male in Verlander. Both of those guys were great to deal with, but there was just a different dynamic. And I remember having a conversation with Anthony DiComo in spring training where we looked at each other and we said, it just feels different, doesn't it? Like, it just feels kind of off. And you don't know why. I don't know why. But then this year, there was just, again, that right mix. And I think it was a lot of different factors. I think Mendoza's steadiness, no doubt, allowed the room to not panic. That's first and foremost. Lindor really becoming comfortable in his own skin, in that room, in this city. You know, he put a ton of pressure on himself to be, like I said, to be everything for everyone because of that contract. And at times, I think it crushed him. And this year, he didn't have any of that. You know, Nimmo has certainly grown into himself. And then when you start to bring in, like I talked about earlier, a JD Martinez, who, similar to a Carlos Mendoza, never panics. He would talk all the time about how the only thing that a rush of adrenaline will do for you is make you perform less. Like, you've got to find a way to manage your emotions at all times. You know, Vientos added a lot to that room. And certainly Iglesias at the end of the day. Like, Sean Manaea. It just, there were, I don't know why. If I knew why, if Terry knew why, if anybody knew why, they would be the richest person in the sport. You don't know why groups just mesh and work well together. There are so many factors. I think they also went through so much together to get themselves out of the hole they put themselves in that they were just so tight-knit by the end, and there was so much belief in the end. And I'll say one other thing. You know, you mentioned Jesse Winker. By all accounts, he didn't have the greatest reputation for a clubhouse guy in the game. And he fit in beautifully there. And I remember talking to somebody in the front office, kind of more generally, not specifically about Winker, but they, when they were at the deadline, I asked, do you have any reservations about who you were going to bring in because the team was so tight knit? And they said, they had a conversation where they said to themselves, if we can bring in somebody who's going to upset the apple cart, then that room isn't what we think it is. And I think that really at its core is what was so special about this group, that they were so strong and so tight knit that no matter who they brought in, it was very clear that you either get in line or you're out. And so Winker, listen, I had nothing but great experiences with him, but whether or not that was who he was throughout the course of his major league career didn't matter, because when he got here, that's who he was, because that's who he had to be, because everybody in that room had to be that way, and that's what made them really special.
Yeah, the fans really took to him as well, even though they hated him with his experience with other teams. But you were there at the very end. I mean, the Mets fell short, didn't make the World Series, but it was such a special season for everybody. Citi Field was a party atmosphere. It was incredible. It was explosive. But they fell short. But after that last game, when they were eliminated, you talk about a tight-knit group and the chemistry that was in that clubhouse. Describe how it was in that very last night in that clubhouse, and how emotional it was, because a lot of guys becoming free agents. So give us a little sense of what was going on that last night.
Yeah, it was honestly, not to keep harkening back to 2015, but I think when you get teams like that that go on these types of runs, you see a lot of similarities. You see similarities in the teams that win and the teams that don't. It was very emotional in that clubhouse. In the same way, you walk in, a lot of hugs, a lot of disappointment. The difference, though, and I think you're right, John, is that in 2015, it felt like, all right, this is just the beginning with this group. You know, certainly with the young pitching staff, and there were a lot of players that were going to be a part of it moving forward. And there was a lot of uncertainty this year, because this team was not built to be the team for the next decade. This team was built to be a transitional team, and they far exceeded expectations. And so what I saw more of was a lot of lingering after, where they didn't want to be away from each other. A lot of guys got together and sat in one corner of the room and just got in a circle and were having a beer, reminiscing about the season and the run. Certainly there was disappointment, but I think there was also an understanding that, A, the Dodgers were a juggernaut and they lost to a really, really darn good team, but also, you know, this season took a lot out of them, and it didn't surprise me that game six went the way it went. Manaea was on his last legs. The pitching had really, you know, pushed itself, I think, as far as it was going to go. And so I think there was a sense of pride in what they accomplished, in a way that, you know, yeah, they're going to be disappointed. They wanted to go all the way, but I think they understood that they accomplished a heck of a lot, and they were proud. But they didn't know what was going to happen after this, and so they wanted to take it in one last time.
Yeah, and it had to be very emotional. And, of course, I have just a couple more. Then we have a couple of fan questions, so appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Now that we're in the offseason, the Mets have 13 free agents. Everyone's filing, and some qualifying offers were made. But the top of the free agent list, Pete Alonso, you have Manaea, you have so many. If you had to predict, and it's probably a hard prediction to make, who do you think have the best chances of coming back to this team in 2025?
The really strange thing is that for a team that was that tight-knit and that successful, I think there is a decent chance that very few, if any, are back next year. I think what Sean Manaea did, and the Mets would love to have Sean Manaea back, but there's every chance in the world that he is going to get the type of contract that the Mets might not be comfortable with. I think they'd love to have, under the right circumstances, the two pitchers back in Manaea and Severino. You know, I've kind of gotten to the point, I don't know the Mets thinking on this, but if Quintana is willing to accept a shorter term deal, I think he's a great guy to bring back, a great guy in the room, great guy to stabilize the back of the rotation. So, you know, it wouldn't stun me if one of those pitchers came back on a shorter term deal, but I think we've seen with David Stearns and his time with Milwaukee, and even the way he approached last offseason, that generally he's not a guy that is keen on going incredibly long term with pitchers because of the volatility there. And then, you know, obviously the name, you know, Jose Iglesias, I would love for them to bring him back, but they've got a lot of infielders that are coming up that they want to give room to. I think Iglesias might get an opportunity somewhere else where he can get a major league deal and assure himself a starting role. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's not back. The one that everybody's going to harp on, rightly so, is Pete Alonso. And I'd be lying to you if I had any real gut feel. I could see it going either way. But the thing that I keep coming back to with Pete is he's with Scott Boras. And the one thing we've seen with Boras over the last number of years is that if the market that they hope for doesn't materialize, they don't take a lesser deal early on. They push this thing to the end. And they sign in mid-March for, you know, if the market doesn't materialize, a three-year deal with two opt-outs. You see that all the time with Boras clients. And I'm not saying that Pete Alonso is not going to have a robust market, but I am saying that if you look at the game today, a first baseman on the other side of 30, that's not what people pay for. And you know, he had some great moments in the playoffs, but he had a down year by his standards this season. And so I think it's going to be fascinating to see how this market develops. And if they are looking for something big and they don't get it, do they drag this thing out all the way to spring training? And in that case, even if the market comes back to the Mets, maybe an area where they're comfortable, at that point, have they already made the decision to move on and build their team in the same way that we saw Atlanta move on with Matt Olson when Freddie Freeman was hanging out there? So I don't know what's going to happen, but that's the scenario that I keep playing in my head where I could see a scenario where at the end of the day, what Pete Alonso signs for is something the Mets would have been comfortable with, but it takes so long that they've already filled the spot, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, it does, actually. It does. Other thing, the other part of the equation is Juan Soto, who said he's going to hear offers from 30 teams. And I read something interesting in MLB.com today because how competitive the Soto situation is going to become with Mets and Yankees, maybe Dodgers, Giants, Nationals even. With a generational player like Soto, if it comes down to Mets and Yankees for Soto, can you see, and this is what I read in MLB.com today, is like if the Yankees are unable to sign Soto, he goes to the Mets, then their number one priority was to fill that first base slot because they just didn't get the option on Anthony Rizzo. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be a very interesting dynamic in the rivalry between Mets and Yankees, taking it to a place that we've never seen before. So I want to get your opinion on that.
I could see it happening. I could see it happening. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what that would be like truly for Mets-Yankees rivalry? But I will say this. So who knows what's going to happen with Alonso? Sure, I could see him, the Yankees, pivoting if they lose Soto. But the really interesting thing to me right now is, what does Juan Soto want? And if Juan Soto wants the most money, and that's it, then if the Mets want him, they're going to get him, you know? And that's the unique position that the Mets organization is in right now, where they have that power with the ownership that if they want somebody bad enough, they should be able to get him. And so I think that the Mets are, if they are not, you know, the leader in the clubhouse, they are right there to sign Soto. Because the one thing I think we saw last year with David Stearns and Steve Cohen is while they're not going to spend wildly on any free agent that's out there, they are going to open up the purse strings for a young player who is going to age well. So we saw that the offer they made for Yamamoto in an offseason where they weren't going for it. And you've got a 26-year-old generational talent that is on the open market that all you need to sign him is cash, and the Mets have that in spades. It's kind of a once-in-a-generation opportunity, and that's why I expect they are going to be all over the Juan Soto sweepstakes. And again, if at the end of the day, he's going to be taking the best offer and that's it, I think there's a really good chance that he's going to be a New York Met then.
It's going to be a crazy offseason for sure. It certainly is. A couple of fan questions and then we'll let you go, Steve. The first one comes from our Facebook account from Bobby Saunders. Steve, you had a chance to witness and be in the moment of some very memorable walk-off wins by the Mets, followed by the on-field interview with the player who just won the game. What has been your most memorable walk-off moments, followed by the interview on the field, and which one gave you the biggest Gatorade bath?
The number one walk-off is easy, and that's Wilmer Flores. That moment will never be topped. For it's hard to remember. Sometimes you get away from it and it, you know, dissipates in your memory a little bit, just how amazing that was. But the emotions associated with that and the way, I mean, Terry, you remember how different it felt for Wilmer Flores in that stadium the day after the trade that didn't go through versus the day before. You know, that fan base, I'd say they were lukewarm on Wilmer. They were fine with if the Mets wanted to move on from him. And he showed them how badly he wanted to be a Met. And he became, at that moment, right then and there, he became an all-time beloved Met. Anytime he walks into Citi Field, he's going to get an ovation. And for him then, the day of the trade deadline, to do that in a huge game, by the way, and to do it in a moment where he hadn't hit a home run in, I feel like he hadn't hit a home run in like a month or a month and a half, and to round third base and, you know, have that Mets jersey that he's pumping his chest with, it was just, I get chills right now even thinking about it. And so to do that interview, that was easily number one. Biggest Gatorade bath, that's hard to even quantify. There was one with Asdrubal Cabrera that might have been the one after he hit the walk-off against the Phillies and he, you know, threw the bat in the air.
Arms up.
Yeah, that was a pretty big Gatorade bath. But the Wilmer one, I truly believe the Wilmer one will never be topped.
Yeah, one of the best memories ever for a Mets fan, and especially for UT seeing the dugout and you covering it on the field. What an exciting moment that was. We have one from the X account. Comes from Amanda Kohut. This goes back to the burrito. But she asked, which was nastier and more traumatic, the Skyline Chili or the burrito from the vending machine?
Both in Cincinnati. You know what my favorite thing is, guys? I say this all the time. I go, you know, last year I spent about 6 weeks doing some of the most in-depth reporting I've ever done. I spoke to probably 40 people around the game about pitcher injuries and the elbow and what was going on, everything behind it. And it was the most proud I've ever been of any reporting work. I was in the booth for like two innings and it went really well. And the only thing that I get asked about when I walk around the stadium is how's your stomach doing after that vending machine burrito? That's all anybody cares about. So no, but the nastier one for me, I would have to say, was the vending machine burrito. The Skyline Chili, I'm not a huge fan of, but like I said, the vending machine burrito, I still can feel it. Like it just sat there. It just sat in my stomach.
May still be there.
Yeah, there's remnants of it still here, definitely. And I remember reading the ingredients on the air. I counted, there were over 90 ingredients in that one burrito. So it's probably not a lot. I don't think that was great for the whole eat whole food trend that's going on nowadays.
We've had a lot of different things that you've had to consume during the course of a season. So we got to take our hat off to you. That'll wrap it up for the questions here. Turn it back to TC. This has been a pleasure.
Well, Steve, it has been a pleasure. Thanks for the time. As you can see, I'm down here in fantasy camp. So, my team's playing pretty good, so I got to get out and make sure we continue towards the championship game on Thursday night here. So, but thanks for your time.
How's the arm?
Great to see you.
As a BP,
my days are over. I watch now. I watch and I don't try to. You know, it's pretty funny. The guys were saying, some of the campers are saying, you know, we want to go back and have that game at the end of the camp against the staff. We, you know, we like to play against you guys. I said, my playing days are over. No. I mean, when you turn 75, Steve, you gotta have say you. I my mind said, yeah, that'd be fun, but my body said, it's not gonna be fun. So it won't be. But thanks for your time, and it's great to see you as always. And all the best. Keep getting those Jets going. I love to tune in and check you out once in a while. So all the best, pal. Thank you very much.
Great seeing you, man. Anytime. John, thanks so much, man.
Well, Terry, Steve Gelbs, is such a great pleasure to have him on the show.
You know, John, I was there when he first burst on the scene, and he was right. I mean, you could tell he was, you know, nervous and tough. But I will tell you, his growth through the years and where he's at today is a tribute to the fact that he was going to make himself better and did. He's fun. He's fun to be around. He's got a great personality, and I hope he continues to try to get back and be a play-by-play guy, because I love to talk to him. I love to be around him. His energy level's off the charts great, and I'm really, really proud of the fact that, you know, I got to be around him and just to see how he's grown, and I wish the best for him.
Yeah, and what a great entertainer he is as well with his on-the-field antics. So what a great guy. It was so great to have him on this week's show. Now it's time for the Tunnel of Towers Amazing Hero of the Week segment. And as we mentioned earlier this week, we're going to debut the video we shot with Hall of Famer and Mets legend Mike Piazza. Let's go to that right now.
Mike Piazza.
Good to see you.
I want to bring you back to 9/11.
Yeah, it was gut-wrenching. It was really range of emotions, from anger, obviously sadness, despair, frustration.
Everybody was looking for a glimmer of hope. 10 days afterwards, you're playing Atlanta. New York was down. There was a lot of 9/11 families that were there that day. And then you're up in the eighth inning, and you hit that miraculous home run.
Lopez wants it away. And it's hit deep to left center. Andrew Jones on the run. This one has a chance. Home run! Mike Piazza and the Mets lead 3-2.
I was very blessed to be in the right place at the right time and have a lot of people pulling for me.
You would not think that sports could do something like that, but it can, and you did.
It's really kind of bittersweet, obviously, to look back, seeing the tragedy of that week.
I know you guys were going down to Ground Zero. You were visiting different firehouses and police offices, and it made a difference.
Listen, we're part of the community. We have to get out there and do what we can. When we came in the room to see them light up a little bit and kind of pick up their spirits, that was something very rewarding, which we were able to help them, and they were able to help us.
Tunnel to Towers Foundation, we made a promise. And the promise is that if you give your kids a kiss goodbye, and you go out there to protect us and you don't come home, then we're going to take care of your family left behind. And we can, in turn, give them a mortgage-free home.
Well, that's a very noble quest. The fact that it comes from your heart is the most important thing. Hi, I'm Mike Piazza. Let's go Mets, and let's help Tunnel to Towers. Just $11 a month will go a long way to support our first responders, soldiers, and veterans. Go to T2T.org for more information on how you can help.
All right, we'll have another T2T Amazing Hero on next week's show featuring former Mets manager Bobby Valentine. Well, Terry, that's going to wrap it up for this edition of the Terry Collins Show. Any final comments as you get ready to get back on the field to manage your team?
Yeah, I've got to get back out there and get my team going. But it's a lot of fun. A great show. I really enjoyed it, John. And I think we're going to have something special next week. So I'm looking forward to seeing you next week.
Same here, Terry. Listen, have a great day. Have a great rest of the week at Fantasy Camp. And that'll wrap up this edition of the Terry Collins Show. You can follow Terry on X and Instagram at @TerryCollins_10. And don't forget to subscribe to our show on your favorite podcast platform or on YouTube. Just look for the Terry Collins Show. For Terry Collins, this is John Arezzi. Have a great week, everyone.